we can go ahead and get started. We're going to be looking at Numbers 21 this morning. And I was just looking at the calendar, and I guess I had miscalculated a couple things. So I'm going to be in California 2 weeks from today. So either we can do this study next week, and then we'll try to figure out how to get back onto the schedule we were on, or something. I'll figure it out, and then get back to everybody on that one. But this morning we're looking at Numbers 21. The plan moving forward, once we're done with Numbers, as we're kind of getting to the home stretch of the book here, is to do Leviticus after this. And I think we'll probably do that in maybe 8 or 10 classes, somewhere in that range. But in Numbers 21, we're looking at the end of this section, really, where the Israelites have been sojourning. Remember, you can remember the book of Numbers with three S's. In chapters 1 through 10, they're at Mount Sinai. Chapters 11 through 21, they've been sojourning. This is where you get the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, plus the beginnings of the new generation, which is what we've been looking at in chapters 20 and 21, and we'll finish that section today. But at the end of chapter 21, or really the beginning of chapter 22, they finally get to the new staging area where they're going to be setting up to enter the promised land. And so that begins with Balak and Balaam and the king of Moab being concerned about the Israelites encroaching closer on their land. And so, Lord willing, next time, I think we'll look at the totality of the Balaam story and kind of hit the highlights. I think it's important to see that as a whole unit. And so that's the plan for the next couple classes in these classes. So, okay, one of the things that we've been looking at, this is going to be the last time you're going to see this chart because this is the last time this applies to what we're looking at. But Numbers 11 through 21, after the first 10 chapters of Numbers, where the only thing the Israelites do is obey God. They're told to number the people, they number them, they're told to take the lepers outside the camp, they take the lepers outside the camp, they're told to make the offerings in chapter 8, they make all the offerings exactly like they were supposed to. Moses asks about doing the second Passover. There's somebody coming over in that door, and I don't, thanks Florian. Or Danny's got it. Florian, Danny's got it. All right. And so in the first 10 chapters, they're just obeying, obeying, obeying. In chapters 11 through 21, this is where we get the series of complaints and grumblings while they're in the wilderness. And there's 7 complaints that they make, and they have a parallel structure. The first complaint and the last complaint deal with various misfortunes. In chapter 11, God sends fire. In the section we're going to be looking at this morning, God is going to send fiery serpents. The second one and the second to the last one, they're complaining about food and water and stuff like this. And in both cases, God does provide for them, but Moses fails to intercede for the people. The third and the third to the last complaints are the complaints about leadership. And in both cases, Moses successfully intercedes for them. And then the middle one in chapters 13 and 14 is where they complain about not being able to enter the promised land. They think that the giants are too big for them and everything, so they have a lack of faith. It's really cowardice that causes them to not enter the land. Fits with what Revelation says about one of the things that will prevent people from being in the new heavens and the new earth is cowardice. And so they have the same problem in Numbers 13 and 14. By the way, I think we mentioned this briefly one time, but do you remember in Acts chapter 2 when Christianity gets started? One of the things that it says in Acts 2 is that they ate their food with glad and generous hearts. Does that sound like a little bit of a reversal from the Old Testament period of time? I think you see some of these pictures that we get in the New Testament, I think, are intentional reversals. That now God is creating a group of people like the kind of people he's always wanted. So, okay. Any comments or questions just about that chart? That's the last time you're going to see it. So you can say bye-bye chart. Okay, so for this morning, just a couple introductory things about Numbers 21 specifically. Numbers 21 begins the conquest. Moses did conquest or lead the conquest on the east side of the Jordan River. What we're going to see in Numbers 21 is three battles, or are three battles. And the other nations are going to be the ones that initiate the battles. It's not like Israel is going around trying to pick a fight with everybody that they can. But Moses is the one that's going to be leading this part. What were the tribes that lived on the east side of the Jordan? Reuben? Manasseh? Half-tribe of Manasseh? Gad and Gad. Those were the 2.5 tribes that live in this territory that Moses is conquering here. And we brought this lesson up last time. I think this is a really undervalued lesson about Moses, is that after he knows he's not going to enter the promised land, and in a sense, all of his earthly hopes are dashed, look at his obedience for the rest of the book. Moses is still fighting. Moses is still doing everything he can to serve the people, even though he knows he's not going to be in the promised land. And I think he stands as a great lesson that if we feel like things on earth are crumbling and the things that we hope for in this life are not going to be obtained by us anymore, would we still serve God? It's kind of like the book of Job, and Moses sort of has an experience like that. So I think, again, that's one of the more undervalued parts of Moses' life towards the end of his life. The outline of chapter 21, there's a kind of a lot going on here. The first 3 verses, the Israelites are going to fight Arad, or however you say that. Verses 4 through 9 is the famous story about the bronze serpent. 10 through 20, it's going to give some traveling that they do towards the promised land. And then 21 to 31 is victory over Sihon. And then the end of the chapter is a victory that they have over Og. And we'll talk about those different places that they fight against. Anything that you guys want to bring up just by way of introduction to this before we get into the text? Okay, let's go ahead and look at Numbers 21. We'll start by reading the first 3 verses here. When the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction." And the Lord heeded the voice of Israel and gave over the Canaanites, and they devoted them and their cities to destruction. So the name of the place was called Hormah. Okay, so as the Israelites are inching closer and closer, there's a problem that happens here. The problem is that Israel is attacked by this king of Arad. And what is this guy called in verse 1? The Canaanite. What has God said about the Canaanites in many passages prior to this one? They're going to be wiped out. So when you see that a passage like this calls this guy the Canaanite, a reader of the Old Testament, the first 5 books of Moses, you should know that these people are going to be wiped out and taken care of in some way. But this guy comes out and attacks them, and what does he do to some of the Israelites? He takes them captive. Do you remember what some of the discouraging things were in chapter 20? You got Miriam's death, you've got Aaron's death, you've got the fate of Moses being sealed, you've got the Edomites saying that you can't pass through our land. Chapter 20 was a really discouraging chapter, and we made the joke that 2020 was a discouraging year, so maybe chapter 21 will be better, and this time it is. But it seems like that chapter 20's discouragements are just kind of bleeding into chapter 21. But notice what it is that the Israelites do. Well, before we do that, I think one observation we can make from this is that when Edom didn't allow them to travel through their land because they were afraid of them, Edom's unkindness towards the Israelites, you can see, I think, are creating some ripple effects for the Israelites. And maybe there's a side lesson, I don't think this is the main point of this passage, but a side lesson that when I'm unkind towards other people and I inconvenience other people, you might not be able to predict all the ripple effects that they might have in their life. And so I think you see that happening with the Edomites here. Okay, so the solution to this problem that they're facing is it, what do the Israelites do? They pray to God. They make a vow to him. And the book of Numbers has talked about vows, like the Nazarite vow, for example. And they say, if you give us victory, we will devote these things to you that are in these cities. Now, it says that they're going to devote them to destruction. I don't think that that means that they were literally going to destroy every precious thing, but they would maybe destroy the houses, not live in the houses. But the gold, silver, all this kind of stuff, that would be devoted to God. And I think you can draw a lesson from this, that if God has given us stuff, what's our responsibility with the things we've been given? To be good stewards. I think about Hannah when she has her child, and it's Samuel, and she dedicates the child to the Lord. Anything that we're given by God's grace in our life, we ought to be using for His purposes. And the Israelites promise that they're going to do that. And I think you see the new generation. There's some better things about them here. You don't really see the old generation making vows like this. I understand that the next few verses they're going to be complaining again. But I think you kind of see the overall trajectory of this new generation a little bit better than the previous one. And so they make this vow, and amazingly the text says that the Lord heeded the voice of Israel. So He's answering their prayer. He's going to give them victory. This promises victories in the future. Anybody know the last time the Israelites had a victory? And if you want to raise both of your hands to answer the question, you can do that. Yeah, when they held up Moses' hands, who were they fighting? The who? No, not the Philistines. The Amalekites. And so it wasn't until, like, you know, 40-some years where they tried to conquer the land in their own power, but they couldn't do that. Anybody know where they tried to conquer the land the first time and they failed, what that place was called? Yeah, in Numbers 14, what was the place where they failed to take the land when they tried to do it without God? I'll give you a hint. It rhymes with Morma. Yeah, it's Horma. And so this is the same place. Did you see that the victory against Arad or Arid or whatever, however you say it, they called the name Horma. I think this is showing us how this place got its name. But it's the same place that we read about in Numbers chapter 14. How sweet of a victory would that be? That in the very place where you failed, now you come back, you do it the right way by vowing to God, you're trusting in Him, unlike they did in chapter 14, and now they have the victory. This kind of relates a little bit to one of the applications I had in the sermon on Sunday morning, but if you've ever had a time where you failed in a certain area and you just wonder if I can really conquer this sin because I've tried to conquer it before and I can't do it, you've got many examples like this in the Bible, where a previous failure is countered when the people come at it with the right mindset the second time. So that's the first victory. It really sets the tone. Chapter 21, it seems like some of these discouragements that could have stuck are starting to be reversed. We'll get to the next section with the bronze serpent, though, next. Anything you guys want to say after the first three verses? Okay, let's go ahead and read the story with the bronze serpent. Look at verses 4 through 9. From Mount Hor, and by the way, if you guys are wondering like where these locations are and everything, I will have a slide that has the maps because it's debated. Some of the routes are debated, so I'll have two maps that have different perspectives on what happened. So look at verse 4. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way to the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient on the way, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and water, and we loathe this worthless food. Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many of the people of Israel died. And the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that He take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten, when he sees it, shall live." So Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a pole, and if a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. Okay, so here's the Israelites, and they are going back to their complaining. What's the reason for the complaint in verse 4? And this stems back again to the Edomites. Taken too long. They're growing impatient, Can you think of any other times that the Israelites, the former generation, grew really impatient, and as a result of their impatience, they sinned? There's probably a bunch of examples. There's one specific one that I'm thinking of when Moses was up on Mount Sinai and the Israelites were at the base of it. And they're like, well, we don't know what happened to this Moses guy. So that happens in Exodus 32. The new generation is growing impatient in this situation as well. What happens when we grow impatient? We're more likely to sin. What are we trying to accomplish with our sins when we're impatient? Right. Right. Waiting on the Lord means that you will never justify sin to try to get a good thing. Waiting on the Lord means that you're going to let him do it in his way and in his timing. And so the Israelites here are growing impatient, again, because of the ripple effects of what Edom did. And I want you to notice how illogical their complaints are. If you tried to stop and think about the times that you've struggled or I've struggled with complaining, and I just try to analyze it from the perspective of logic, how logical are complaints? So look at what they're complaining. The first one, why have you brought us out here to die? So God brought them out there to bring them to the promised land. If any of them died in the wilderness, whose fault was it? It was their own fault. So the second one, there's no food and water. What's God been doing all throughout Numbers? Giving them the manna. And then I really like this third one in light of what they said in the second complaint. We loathe this worthless food. There's no food, and we loathe this worthless food. It doesn't make any sense. And so it's a sign of thanklessness. And one question that I think we could ask ourselves with this is, are we better at itemizing and listing out our complaints or our blessings? These people seem very adept at being able to list out all the grievances that they have about life. But if you were to ask them, well, what are you thankful for? I don't know that they would be able to have as many details about that. And so I think that's a thing to consider there. Any comments or questions just up to verse 5, I guess? Yeah. Right. And I think in Numbers 11, when God sends a fire when they complain, I think that literally happened, but it also has a metaphorical imagery. That complaining spreads like fire. I've talked about this before, but the number one emotion that's shared on social media is anger. And anger oftentimes accompanies complaining. It just spreads everywhere. And by the way, if I have the printed out PowerPoint slides up here, so don't feel like if you're wanting to write everything down, all of it's right here. So you can have it after the class. Anything else you guys want to say about their complaints here? All right, so as a result, God sends fiery serpents. Now, when I would first read this passage, and whenever I would think about this, I was always confused on what the text meant by fiery serpent. What do you think the text means when it says that the serpents were fiery? And I can think of three options. Yeah, the sting had like a burning sensation to it. That's one option. And by the way, Deuteronomy 8:15 is one of the other passages that say that you lived in this wilderness filled with fiery serpents. What's another option on what fiery means? I think it could be their color. I think it's the carpet viper. If you look up pictures of the carpet viper, which would live in this area, it kind of has like a bronzy, kind of fiery kind of coloration to it. I used to think when I first was reading the Bible, I thought that the snakes were supernaturally like inflamed. And they were like, I don't think that's the case. God sends these fiery serpents. And notice that what happened to the many of the Israelites because of the serpents? They died. Have you ever like just been on a walk and you saw a snake that you thought could have been venomous? Even if it's like a really small, well, apparently the small ones are the most dangerous. But it's so scary to just see one snake. Like we had one in our yard not too long ago. And so can you imagine like a ton of these things slithering all over the place? I want you to see here that God thought that this was an appropriate response to when people complained. So if I ask myself, well, what do I deserve? Like, do I deserve to have a bunch of scary, slithering snakes come all over me because of my complaining? God, this is the God that we all serve, and he thought this was the appropriate response to this. So if we think that's inappropriate, we're the ones who are wrong. God is the one who knows. And so that's what he did for this situation. I think also symbolically, the first time we read about a serpent in the Bible is Satan, and he's caused even more people to die with his venom that inflicts deeper problems than just something that can happen to your physical body. So anything you guys want to say through verse 6? Yeah, I think so. I think when it says that, okay, God tells Moses, I didn't realize this really till even yesterday, but when God tells Moses to make a fiery serpent, he turns around and makes a bronze one. It doesn't say that he made a fiery serpent. So I think the coloration is the thing that's being, is maybe, and then also the burning sensation. I don't think they were supernaturally inflamed or anything like that, like I used to think. Okay, so then look at what Moses does. God tells him, the people confess their sin, and then they ask for his prayers. So they go in this text from speaking against Moses and complaining against him to now pleading for his help. And I think what's happened here is God is allowing the adversity to teach them to reprioritize. You know, like they're complaining that they don't have really nice food and all that. Well, what if suddenly your life was in danger? Would you be complaining about whether or not you're able to go to your favorite restaurants and have your favorite kinds of coffee and stuff? This adversity that God sends to them, I think, is causing them to ask themselves what really matters right now. And we know that Moses is the one that we have to go to. This ends up becoming the last complaint that the Israelites make about food. And so I think they're starting to maybe learn some things from all of this. So Moses prays. One thing that we've noted throughout chapters 11 through 21 is that if Moses wasn't ever living to make intercession for the people, where would the Israelites have been? The implication on several occasions is that they would have just been destroyed completely. And God would have started over with Moses, so the lineage of Abraham would have continued, and God's promises to Abraham would have been secure. But that those people would have been destroyed. And for us, where would we be without Jesus who lives to make intercession for us? That's what the New Testament, I think, would go on to help us see. Would you have prayed for these people? They were just like spitting in your face, and then they turn around and they're asking for your help. Aren't those the kind of situations where we're most tempted to say, nope? Yeah. Right. Good. Right. Yeah. Moses was their mediator. Like, you know, he was the one that could go out to the tent and commune with God. This is one of the benefits that we have in the new covenant. Jesus is our eternal high priest. They did just make a vow to God. You know, it doesn't say that they went through anything, but Moses was the guy that had the connection with God that none of them had in the same way. So, all right. So the solution, were you gonna say something? No. Okay. Okay. So the solution is that Moses makes this bronze serpent. God doesn't remove the serpents from among the people, but he gives them a solution to it. And so it's amazing that God is willing to even offer them a solution to this problem. And after all the things he's done for them, after all the things God's done for us, does he still offer us a way out of our complaining and a way out of the sinful mindsets that we have? Here's a question that I have about this, though. I've always wondered this. Why take the very thing that was killing the people and make a replica of it? And if you look at that, the very thing that was killing you, if you look at the thing that was killing you, then you'll live. Anybody have a good idea on that? Or an idea? It doesn't have to be a good one. Okay, good. And maybe even like the acknowledgement of like these serpents were the ones that were killing us. It was because of our sin, and we have to acknowledge it by looking at this. Like, yeah, that's, you know, this was the just thing that God sent. We're going to acknowledge it. Maybe it's kind of like a form of confession. Any other ideas? Yeah, so he's taking the thing that caused the problem and weaving good into it. So another way we could say it is he's taking a symbol of death and making it into a symbol of life. Does that sound like anything that maybe Jesus did? Right. Right. Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah. That's right. And Jesus is going to, in the Gospel of John, Jesus says it on several occasions that he's going to be lifted up. He's going to be lifted up. And he compares himself to the serpent that was lifted up. So the symbol of death, we as Christians, we have to trust in the execution of somebody as the means by which we are saved from death. So I think this goes to what Joan was saying, that he's taking the symbol of death and he's making it into a symbol of life. He's making good come from this. And maybe also the form of confession that they have to acknowledge this. Okay, Bible trivia. Anybody know what ends up happening to this bronze serpent later on in Old Testament history? It becomes an idol that later Hezekiah. In 2 Kings 18, Hezekiah has to remove when he's taking all the idolatry out of the land. And so they kept this thing and they worshipped it. Does anybody know the name that they gave the bronze serpent? It was Nehushtan, is what they ended up calling it. And so it would have been in the place of worship. And I think one lesson we can learn from that is that we don't worship the means by which God helps us if it's not God himself. So if God has helped us through people that have meant a lot to us or something, we don't worship the people. We worship the God that used those people. And so I think that was a problem later on for them. Okay, so anything else you guys want to say about the bronze serpent story? Can you imagine whoever had to carry that thing around in the wilderness? And then they like put it in a storage shed or something by the tabernacle. And then one day they're like, hey, this thing was kind of cool. Do you remember that story? Like maybe it'll save us still or something. I don't know. But we can take good things God has given us and end up, and this was not even supposed to be a good thing on a continual basis. This was supposed to be a good thing for a period of time. Verses 10 through 20, they're starting to travel towards the promised land. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to survey some of this and then show you the map about this on the next PowerPoint slide. So we're not going to read this section, but what we're going to see as they travel is the text is going to emphasize Moab several times here. It's going to mention Moab in verse 11, verse 13, verse 20, because that's the staging ground for getting ready to enter into the promised land. The idea being that they're inching their way closer and closer to this place. Numbers 33, when we get to Numbers 33, this is the chapter where we have the travel log, and it tells us all 42 places that they stayed during the 40 years of wilderness wandering. I will say, and it'll be on the map, there are debates about the route that they traveled, because we don't know where all of these locations are today. But there's some general things that we can be more sure of. So if you try to look at different atlases, some of them will have different ideas of where exactly how the travel route worked. But interspersed in this little travel log here, there's two poems. Verses 14 and 15, talks about a quote from the Book of the Wars. It's a book that the Bible references that we don't have today. Does anybody know any other books that the Old Testament references that we don't have in our Bibles? Yes, good. The book of Jasher, which is mentioned in Joshua 10 and 2 Samuel chapter 1. There's the books, the Chronicles of the Kings, that 1 and 2 Kings talks about. That's not 1 and 2 Chronicles. And so there's several times where the Old Testament and the New Testament, actually, will mention books that are not in our Bibles. This little poem that is brought up here mentions Wahab and Sufa. They could be sources that go into the Arnon River because this would be in that kind of region, but we're not sure about that. verses 16 through 18, I'll go ahead and read these ones. And from there they continued to Beer, that is the well of which the Lord said to Moses, gather the people together so that I might give them water. Then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing to it. The well that the princes made, that the nobles of the people dug with the scepter and with their staffs. Okay, so as they're journeying, what does God provide for them? From a well. This, so before he's provided from a rock, now he's providing from a well. God has different ways of providing our needs for us. But when they get this water, how do they react? Okay, so they travel on. But what do they do in this poem? Yeah, like, and they're praising God for giving them this water. So isn't it, this is amazing that they've been complaining, and here's one of the first genuine times in Numbers 11 through 21 where they really seem thankful, where their complaining has turned to rejoicing. These things really can change in our life. If we feel like life is just so hard and so many things are so hard, how can I ever stop really complaining? How can I get these things figured out? Here's an example of God having been so patient with these people. So patient so that they could figure it out. That's one of the reasons that he's patient with us, is so that we can keep growing. So, okay, anything you guys want to say about this travel section? I'll show you the map next. Okay, here's the map. So this is the map that I showed you last time, where this is the Edomite territory right here. And when the Israelites tried to pass through Edomite territory, they said no. So one idea is that they went all the way down here and went through the desert highway rather than the king's highway, so they're not traveling through Moab. Now the problem with that view is that if they went this direction, there's certain areas like Arad that we know they were just at to fight. So then you kind of wonder, okay, were they like going back and forth a lot during this period of time? It's possible. But the other idea is that they go over here to the King's Highway area. The Edomites, they would go up here to Mount Hor. This is where Aaron dies. They try to go into Edomite territory to the King's Highway. Edom says no. And so they go up here and they fight the people at Horma, and then maybe they go somewhere else. But so the idea is we know the overall trajectory. They're going north. They're getting closer and closer to Moab. Exactly how they got there, that's up for debate. And I don't know that I have the answer. I know I don't have the answer to that. I don't know that a lot of scholars have a definitive idea of this either. But that's the best we can do with that, at least, or I can. Anything you guys want to say about that or ask about that? In other words, the map that I showed you a couple weeks ago, this one could be wrong. I just didn't realize that it was such a debated issue until this week. So, okay. Verses 21 to 31 has got victory over Sihon. And the text begins with a very diplomatic request. Moses asks them in verses 21 and 22, can we pass through your territory just like he did with the Edomites? But just like the Edomites, these people of Sihon are not going to let them do it. Later on in Old Testament history, when Jephthah is talking about what happened in these days, it says this in Judges 11, verse 20. Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together, and then there's going to be this battle that takes place. And so Sihon is instigating the battle. He loses. Look at verse 20. Let's see. So they beat them. Look at verse 25. And Israel took all these cities, and Israel settled in all the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon, and all its villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and taken all his land out of his hand as far as the Arnon. And then skip down to verse 31. Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. Okay. So the Israelites settle in this land. Again, Moses is conquering part of the promised land. What city is singled out as being one of the ones that they settle in? Yeah, Heshbon. So you see that like in verse 26, I think it was. Who previously occupied that city? The Moabites. Okay. In the context of what we're looking at here, anybody know what happens with the Moabites, with Balaam and Balak? Like, go over to chapter 22 really quick. Numbers 22, verses 1 through 3. Then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was in great dread of the people, because there were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. What had apparently recently happened to the Moabites? Who had destroyed them? Sihon did. And Sihon had taken over some of the territory of the Moabites. The Moabites, I guess, had retreated back into their more mainland area and had continued to live there. And it seems like the previous king had died, but it's recent history, it seems. And so everybody remembers that. And who just defeated Sihon? The Israelites did. Does Moab know that Sihon is powerful? So if there's a nation more powerful than Sihon that's encroaching on you, what do you know is going to happen to you? You're cooked. And this is why we get him hiring Balaam so he can try to curse the people. That adds some context to what we're going to be looking at in the next class. We just talked about that. All right, so this victory is used to encourage future victories. That should be verse 24, I think. Oh, yeah, no. Verse 34 is right. When they actually fight Og, when they go to battle against Og, God is going to say, remember what I just did to Sihon. You guys can defeat Og as well. All right, so that kind of sets the context for what happens in verses 27 to 30. So verses 27 to 30 are very unique in the Bible. And the reason is because verses 27 through 30 is actually an ancient poem of the Amorites that has been inserted, I think by the Holy Spirit, into Numbers. And what I want to do is to just read this poem and ask yourself as I read this, why is a Amorite poem celebrating Sihon's former victory in this passage? So look at verses 27 to 30. By the way, this is the third poem in Numbers 21. The first two were by the Israelites. The third one, this is a pagan poem. All right. Therefore, the ballad singers say, come to Heshbon, let it be built. Let the city of Sihon be established. For fire came out from Heshbon, flame from the city of Sihon, it devoured Ar of Moab, that must have been the former king possibly, and swallowed the heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, O Moab, you are undone, O people of Chemosh. He has made his sons fugitives and his daughters captives to the Amorite king Sihon. So we overthrew them, Heshbon as far as Dibon perished, and we laid waste as far as Nophah, fire spread as far as Medeba. So after Sihon, king of the Amorites, had defeated Moab, the ballad singers wrote this great song about how great this king was and how great these victories were. Why would it be valuable for us to have a pagan poem here? Yeah, you see their false religion? Yeah, and based on this poem that the enemy had, how powerful was the enemy? And like, was this poem really well known? Do you think that after this victory, like, this was shared in the ballad singers. It says that the ballad singers say, like, they had, like, little traveling bands going all over the place, possibly singing the song. And so I think that's right, that this is showing Sihon's strength. It was widely acknowledged how strong these people were. And they even say in verse 29, "Woe to you, O Moab, you are undone, O people of Chemosh." They're saying, well, your god Chemosh, you guys have been let down by your god. But then notice that it says in verse 30, "So we overthrew them." What does this poem really celebrate and give the credit to? Well, he's saying that the Chemosh, god of the Chemosh, was the god of the Moabites. That god was destroyed, but we defeated them. That the Amorites, we are powerful. So it's self-praising. And so, like, this is what the world said about the Amorites. Powerful. Nobody can defeat them. They've destroyed other gods. And then here comes God's people, and what do? They crush them. The world can be enamored with all kinds of power and might, and they can sing about their power and might, but who's always more powerful? The Lord is. God knows more than the psychologists do about our sin. God knows how to overcome our sin better than the psychologist. Like, any expert you can trot out who maybe has touched on some things that are actually true, God knows how to get deeper and actually eradicate the problem. So these people were very impressed with worldly power. It was a widely known song. And what happens when these people, this is their favorite tune. I love that song whenever those people travel and they sing that song about how strong we are. And then they find out that there's another nation that's been a nomadic tribe for 40 years that came and destroyed you. All right. And this just really sums it up. Sihon defeated Moab. Israel defeated Sihon. So God is with them. Any comments or questions about that? Really cool section in Numbers that you actually have a pagan poem wedged into all of this. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. In this poem, they're not like praising their god, but you can imagine that they would think, well, you know, our god is more powerful than that regional god because that regional god was destroyed. Yeah. So, okay, cool. Then look at, so we're not going to read verse 32. The Israelites dispossessed another place called Jazer. I'm not sure where this fits. Was this another place that belonged to Sihon? Or is this an outlying area of where Og dwells, which we're about to read about in just a second? But the Israelites sent spies to another place and dispossessed them, so they're just having lots of victories. But look at verses 33 to 35. Then they turned and went up by the way to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against them, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand, and all the people and all his people and his land. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon." So they defeated him and his sons and all his people until he had no survivor left, and they possessed his land. So there's a lot of possessing of the land happening here. But this battle takes place 30 miles east of the Sea of Galilee. This is on the east side of the Jordan River. Reuben, Gad, half-tribe of Manasseh. This is, again, he's conquering these places. Does anybody remember what the book of Deuteronomy tells us about this King Og? So it says, Deuteronomy says quite a bit, actually, about this battle. But Deuteronomy 3:11, it says, "For only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bed was a bed of iron. 9 cubits was its length, and 4 cubits its breadth." So what is Og? He's a big dude. What were the Israelites scared of in Numbers 13? Big dudes. And so here they are, the new generation, and they're going out to battle against Og and his children, who I imagine were also pretty big people. And so earlier they were scared of these kinds of people, and now they're going to be victorious over them. God assures them, look back to what I just did. You guys just destroyed the Amorites and Sihon, and based on that confidence that you should have gained from that victory, know then that God will give you victory over here in this battle. We also know from Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 4, that they actually destroyed 60 cities in all of this, and they dispossessed 60 cities. Remember, the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' final speeches to the new generation, and he's recording recent history to them so that they can have encouragement to keep moving forward to finish the conquest. So I think what we see here is that with the conquest on the east side of the Jordan complete, we think about the conquest just being the book of Joshua. It really, part of the conquest, the east side of the conquest, happens in Numbers 21. And then there's probably a couple other things that we'll comment on in like Numbers 30 as well. But the bulk of the conquest on the east side happens in Numbers 31. This is where the conquest starts. And so if God can be victorious on one side of the Jordan, can he be victorious on the other side? And in like manner, if God can give us victory over one sin, does that promise us that he can conquer the other ones in our life too? Like if there's something that you've really struggled with, and you try to think, okay, well, there's a couple things that I struggle with, and then I can even look back to certain things that I used to do a lot more, or I didn't do as much as I should have, and I really, like, God has really helped me get control of that. That means that you know what it's like to let him work through you. He's not limited in his power. He can help you with the other things as well. And so I think all of this is a lot of confidence boosting for the nation as they seek to take the rest of the land. Any other thoughts or comments on any of that? All right. Well, we'll end a few minutes early then this morning. So I'll send out the email when I know exactly how this is going to work for the next study. But next time, I think, like I said, we're going to try to do Numbers 22, 23, and 24. I might end up breaking it into two classes because sometimes the story of Balaam might be looked at kind of big picture only. So I'll kind of determine that as I try to get ready for that. But I think it's good to see the big picture, but it's also good to maybe study it slowly. I don't know. We'll see. Okay, I'll go ahead and close this out with a word of prayer, and then we'll be done for today. Our great God, we thank you so much that you have left us so many stories that give us inspiration. We know that you are more powerful than all the things that our world thinks to be powerful. We know that with your help and with the power that you allow to work within us, that we can overcome our complaining, that we can become people who understand contentment, that we can become people who begin to look more and more like your Son. We thank you so much, Father, for your patience in our life. We thank you for the examples in the book of Numbers as we see the patience that you had with your people in ancient days. And we pray that we would take the patience that you have towards us right now, and that we would use that time that you give us to grow and to become more holy so that your name can be honored and glorified. We thank you so much for this time. We pray that it strengthens us and it gives us a greater resolve to defeat sin in our life so that your name can be honored. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.